Brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, we suggested at our last class when we looked at Obadiah that Obadiah's prophecy came fairly early in time. And that, we suggested, was illustrated by its place in the canon of Scripture. Now, on the same basis, in its place in the canon of these minor prophets, we can say that Zephaniah comes fairly late in the series of prophecies. But this is confirmed for us now by looking at chapter 1 and verse 1. There we read, "The word of Yahweh which came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hizkiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah." So there's no doubt about it here, it's in the days of Josiah. Now this is that Josiah who, you remember, carried out reform in Judah. But you remember that when he carried out his reforms, though the people were with him because it was the king's instruction, in their hearts they were not. There was no true reform amongst the people. Only the king himself was really zealous in the days of those reforms. Zephaniah the prophet seemed to have had a significant effect upon Josiah the king, but not upon the people at large. And we can see why when later in Zephaniah he ends up with talking about a remnant only. But what about the name Zephaniah? The name Zephaniah means hidden of Yah. Hidden of Yah. But what is unusual about Zephaniah is that we have so much of his lineage. We read that he's of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hizkiah. So you come down this line to Hizkiah and you think, well, there must be something important about Hizkiah. That is why it must be mentioned. And I think it comes out when we realize that the name Hizkiah is Hezekiah. And it almost certainly must be Hezekiah, king of Judah, who in his day had carried out, you remember, great reforms which affected the people greatly at that time. Now you come down to Zephaniah as a descendant of Hizkiah or Hezekiah, and evidently a relative of the king, a relative of Josiah. And one wonders how much effect this prophet Zephaniah had upon his relative Josiah and the king to encourage him to put into practice the same kind of reforms which Hezekiah had done earlier. Now I think we can see this come out of this prophecy. For example, in chapter 2 of Zephaniah and verse 3. Now we have an urgent plea here from the prophet. And let's see this as a plea to the king for the moment. "Seek ye Yahweh, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness. Seek meekness. It may be ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger." So you can see how, setting about his reforms, the book of the law was found and was brought before Josiah and was read before him, and you remember that how much he repented when the book of the law was read before him. And it looks as if Zephaniah becomes a significant factor in this. But what makes Zephaniah's message so urgent, you see, is that he refers seven times to the day of Yahweh. It's almost as if the whole theme of Zephaniah's message is the day of Yahweh. Now we put this on the slide, and what we have here is Zephaniah's prophecy. We've suggested on the slide, is that two, can you see that date at the top, BC 625? Obviously we don't know exactly the date. We would generally suggest around about the year 625 BC. Josiah has but newly come to the throne at that time. Now you'll notice these seven times in which the day of Yahweh is mentioned, slightly different phrases. In chapter 1, verse 7, it says, the day of Yahweh is at hand. In chapter 1, verse 8, it says, the day of Yahweh's sacrifice. Chapter 1, verse 14, the day of Yahweh is near. Again in verse 14 of chapter 1, the voice of the day of Yahweh. Now I think by putting it up this way, you can see what is happening. Zephaniah's message is evidently of extreme urgency. The day of Yahweh is near. It's a sacrifice. It's at hand. There's a voice of the day of Yahweh. It can be heard approaching, as it were. The voice of the day of Yahweh. In chapter 1, verse 18, it's the day of Yahweh's wrath. Now all these expressions are intended to instill fear, awe, and a deep sense of urgency into the minds of the people. The day of Yahweh's wrath. In chapter 2, verse 2, the day of Yahweh's anger, which is repeated in chapter 2, verse 3 again. The day of Yahweh's anger. And though we, brethren and sisters, as Judah in the past would think of the day of Yahweh as a day of anger and of wrath upon the heathen nations, what comes home in a terrible way in Zephaniah is that the day of Yahweh will here be primarily upon Judah itself. So we just put here, Zephaniah, hidden of Yah, it's of Hizkiah or Hezekiah, king of Judah, and related to King Hosea. So those who want to get them down, there they are. If you've got them down, well, I'll leave them for one moment, and then we'll take them off. But what also comes out of this, of course, is that Zephaniah is a contemporary of Jeremiah the prophet. And one might imagine, therefore, that there are many overtones of the ideas in the two prophets, and certainly there are. Now, we want to try and tie down exactly when, in the life of Josiah, the prophecy of Zephaniah was written. Was it before Josiah's reforms, or was it afterward? Now, both ideas have been suggested. If you look at chapter 1 and verse 8, chapter 1 and verse 8 says, it shall come to pass in the day of Yahweh's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with strange apparel. Now some have suggested it must be late because the king is not mentioned here. It mentions the princes and the king's children. So because it mentions the king's children, some say it must be late in Josiah's reign. Against that, however, the suggestion is that this really shows the foresight of the prophet. And I really think that is right. Because if we come now to verse 5 of chapter 1, in verse 5 it says, and them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops, them that worship and that swear by Yahweh and that swear by Malcolm, them that are turned back from Yahweh, those that have not sought Yahweh nor inquired of him. Now, those words don't sound like the time of Josiah's reform. We know Josiah is king. But if they're worshipping the host of heaven and they're swearing by Yahweh and by Malcolm and that some have turned back from him, that couldn't be after the reforms have been instituted. It surely must have been before. So we would suggest that this prophecy comes very early in Josiah's reign. And I'd suggest the truth is, of course, that this prophecy has a lot to do with Josiah's motive for the reform. There's such urgency. The day of Yahweh is at hand. There's such urgency in this call for repentance, lest Yahweh's anger be poured out upon them, that it would certainly give Josiah the incentive that he required for his reforms. Look at chapter 2 and verse 1 of Zephaniah. Chapter 2. Gather yourselves together, yea, gather together, O nation not desired, before the decree bring forth, before the day passes the chaff, before the fierce anger of Yahweh come upon you, before the day of Yahweh's anger come upon you. And it would give this relative coming in, a godly man, a man of some stature in Israel, coming in before Josiah, and putting this message to him, reminding Josiah of the reforms of King Hezekiah, no doubt had a lot to do with Josiah's reform. So Zephaniah's message is the coming day of Yahweh. The coming day of Yahweh. Well, we're in the situation where the day of Yahweh is coming. So let's give the breakup of this prophecy. You'll notice we've got here chapter 1, verse 2. This is suggested breakup of the prophecy. Chapter 1, verse 2, through to chapter 2, verse 3, is the day of Yahweh on Judah. The day of Yahweh on Judah. In chapter 2, verses 4 to 7, we have judgment of Philistia. Now, if you think about, in your mind, of the map of Israel, Philistia is in the west. In chapter 2, verse 8 to 11, we have the judgment of Moab and Ammon. Now, Moab and Ammon are not in the west. They're very opposite to Philistia. They are in the east. Then in chapter 2, verse 12, we have the judgment on Ethiopia and Egypt. But Ethiopia and Egypt are now in the south. And then in chapter 2, verses 13 to 16, we have the judgment of Assyria. And as opposite to Ethiopia and Egypt, of course, Assyria is in the north. So in those judgments on Philistia, Moab and Ammon, Ethiopia and Egypt and Assyria, we have the four points of the compass: west, east, south, north. In other words, we come to this point here where it says Jerusalem becomes the centre of trouble in the whole region. As if the whole region is in turmoil, the day of Yahweh is poured out upon all those nations, and right in the middle, in the vortex of this outpouring of divine anger, is Jerusalem. And Zephaniah intends the people, with fear, to recognise that and repent before it's too late. The judgments were carried out by the Chaldeans. And the Chaldeans came from the north. In other words, what we want to impress is they're the northern invader. And once we see that the judgments are carried out by the northern invader, then we can appreciate again how applicable these words are to later periods of time, to our own time as well. Now we come to chapter 3, in the breakup of chapter 3, we've got verses 1 to 7, that lists the sins of Judah. Verses 1 to 7 lists the sins of Judah, and then chapter 3, verse 8 to verse 20, the restoration of the remnant of Israel. Sins of Judah, the restoration of the remnant of Israel. So there we are. That's the way we'd suggest how the whole book is broken up. Now there's three chapters there, and I'm not going to try and give you, which you'll be pleased to hear, a detailed exposition of three chapters in one night. But, yes, thank you. Coming then to Zephaniah chapter 1, let's move on into verses 2 and 3. And what we want to notice, first of all, as we read verses 2 and 3, how reminiscent these words are of what is spoken in Genesis 6 and verse 7 of the reason why Yahweh brought the flood upon the land. Verse 2, I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith Yahweh. I will consume man and beast. I will consume the fowls of the heaven and the fishes of the sea and the stumbling blocks with the wicked. And I will cut off man from off the land, saith Yahweh. The words are virtually identical to what is written in Genesis 6 verse 7. With this is difference, of course, that the Genesis 6 verse 7 ends with the words, for it repenteth me that I have made him. Now that isn't here in Zephaniah. It repenteth me that I have made him. But even so, when you look again at that verse 3, there's something that was not in the flood. Did you pick that out as we read it? Something that's not in the flood. I will consume man and beast. That happened in the flood. I'll consume the fowls of the heaven. That happened in the flood. And the fish of the sea. They were not destroyed in the flood. In other words, the implication here is that in some respects, when the day of Yahweh comes, it will be worse than it was in the time of the flood. Because even the fish of the sea are mentioned here. And then it says, going on in verse 3, the stumbling blocks with the wicked. The margin for stumbling blocks mentions the idols. The word is stumbling blocks, but no doubt the idols are intended by that expression. But we need to see out of Zephaniah the relevance of these words to our own time and to our own ecclesia. So that in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 41, when the Lord Jesus Christ gave the parable of the wheat and the tares, he said, "The Son of Man shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend." Now that word offend is really the same idea. It's stumbling blocks. So Matthew 13 verse 41, in this, what the Lord really says is, "The Son of Man shall gather out of his kingdom all stumbling blocks." It gives a relevance to Zephaniah to the day when the Roman armies overthrew Judea. And it also reminds us, brethren and sisters, that all these things are written for our learning, upon whom the ends of the world are come, that we might also take the lesson from these prophecies. Well, verse 4, then, starts really into the sins of Judah. Verse 2 had said all things. So you've got the idea that it's all these nations of the region that will feel the wrath of Yahweh. But in particular, it stresses that this judgment will fall upon Judah. Verse 4, "I will also stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place, and the name of the Chemerim with the priests, and them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops, and them that worship and that swear by Yahweh, and that swear by Malcolm or Molech, them that are turned back from Yahweh, and those that have not sought Yahweh nor inquired of him." So the sins of Judah, for which this day of Yahweh falls upon them, is because of their idolatry. And idolatry is a worship of self. It might seem strange. You might think it was a worship of an idol. Who makes the idol? Man does. And how is the idol worshipped? By man's dictates. And in such a way that man's basest instincts are satisfied. This is why idolatry always, in the end, came back to the two prime factors of all the media today and of life at the present time: immorality and violence. And the two go together. Immorality and violence. It's a worship of self, which was centered on the idol, but the idol represents oneself. Now, did you notice that when we looked at that verse, read that verse 4 there, it says, "I will stretch out mine hand." Stretch out mine hand upon Judah. And that was intended to make them think, stretch out mine hand. What does it remind us of? Surely in our minds it takes us back to the Exodus. When Yahweh stretched out his hand, as it says in Exodus 6 and verse 6, he stretched out his hand over the Egyptians to redeem Israel and to bring them out of that country. But now, in stretching out his hands, not upon Egypt, but upon Judah. Such is how the tables have turned. And Judah has become like Egypt of old. It speaks of the remnant of Baal and of the Chemerim. The Chemerim, history tells us, were black-frocked priests. You can see them any day of the week. They belong to the Roman Catholic Church, to the Greek Orthodox Church, and a number of others. The black robe priests of Baal. Now, the idea, of course, came from the surrounding nations. But it was the northern kingdom of Israel that first had these priests in this way. You might like to come back a page or two to Hosea and chapter 10. To Hosea and chapter 10. We read in Hosea chapter 10 and verse 5, "The inhabitants of Samaria shall fear because of the calves of Beth-Aven." You remember these calves which were set up by Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that made Israel to sin, ringing down the pages of the Old Testament. So here are the calves of Beth-Aven. It says, "For the people thereof shall mourn over it, and the priests thereof that rejoiced on it for the glory thereof, because it is departed from it." And where it's got the priests there, you'll have in the margin Kemarim. They were black-frocked priests, no doubt with white collars, who led the worship of the golden calves. For that, Israel was destroyed. It seems extraordinary that, not learning the lesson, Judah now has followed the same pattern. And you've got these idolatrous black-robed priests, the Kemarim, in Judah as well. You'll notice in verse 5 of Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 5, "Them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops." The housetops, as we know, was the place of prayer. And Peter was his one, went to the rooftop to pray, and there he had the vision of the all manner of beasts let down upon a sheet, that he might be led to preach the gospel to Cornelius and to the Gentiles. The housetop was the place of prayer, but now they're worshipping the host of heaven, the stars. Probably the nearest description we would have to this today is the zodiac. Certainly the signs of the zodiac go back a long way. I have seen in one of the tombs in the Valley of Kings in Egypt the sign of the zodiac painted over the vault, over the coffin of the king. It goes back a very long way. It's worshipping the host of heaven. And of course, as you know, today, there's not only the zodiac and all that superstition, but there is the host of heaven, that is the saints, which are worshipped in all sorts of extraordinary ways. But then it goes on in that verse to five, "Of those that swear by Yahweh and that swear by Malcolm." Now, Malcolm, or Molech, as it's generally put elsewhere, and surely Malcolm or Molech is Baal. Baal, you remember, means Lord. Lord. How do we have it as Molech? The Hebrew word for king is Melech. M-E-L-E-C-H. Baal, Lord, or to put it another word, Melech, meaning king. The word Bosheth, you heard of Ich Bosheth, and so on. The word Bosheth means shame or abomination. So what they had done, they had taken Melech, king, and replaced the vowels of the word for king, and put in its place the vowels from Bosheth, which means shame or abomination. It was a form of mockery of Baal. So that Melech became Molech. It's a combination of shame or abomination with the word king. The terrible thing is, of course, that now they are worshipping Baal themselves in Judah. You'll notice there's three classes here, by the way, in the verses which we have read. You've got those that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops. In other words, they're completely given over to idolatry. They don't worship Yahweh at all. You've got those who are in the halfway, as it were. They swear by Yahweh and by Malcolm. There's a blending of truth and error. And then in verse 6, the third class are those that are turned back from Yahweh. So you've got idolaters, those with divided worship, and those who are unbelievers completely. Three classes in Judah in this way. Let's just compare now with Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 8. Here we read in Jeremiah 7 verse 8. Behold, ye trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will ye steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom ye knew not, and come and stand before me in this house which is called by my name, and say, we're delivered to do all these abominations? Jeremiah picks up much of the same idea, you see. They trust in lying words, they steal, they murder, they commit adultery, they swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, walk after other gods, the host of heaven, and still they come before Yahweh and have that audacity to appear before him as if he will accept them. When then the rest of the week, from Monday to Friday, they have gone after their abominations, and on Sunday morning they're found assembling with the ecclesia. It ought not to be. It cannot be. So let's come back to Zephaniah chapter 1 again then. And in Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 7, here the words are, hold thy peace at the presence of the Lord Yahweh. What a phrase. Hold thy peace at the presence of the Lord Yahweh, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. For Yahweh hath prepared a sacrifice, he hath bid his guests. Hold thy peace. You know, when Yahweh manifests himself in this day of anger, in this day of wrath, we have the words of the prophet Habakkuk in chapter 2 and verse 20, who says, Yahweh is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. And when he comes and pours out devastating judgment, they will keep silence before him when he is in his holy temple. Now it says in that verse 7, that the day of Yahweh's sacrifice, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. The day of Yahweh is at hand. First it was the Babylonian. That was why it was at hand in the time of Zephaniah. Subsequently it would be the Roman, another northern invader. Lastly it will be Gog. And they come as guests. Yahweh hath prepared a sacrifice. He hath bid his guests. And a sacrifice must be made upon an altar. The sacrifice is Judah. The altar is Jerusalem. You might like to make a note of Jeremiah 46 and verse 10 as a comparison. And perhaps we'll just turn to Ezekiel chapter 39. In Ezekiel chapter 39 and verse 17, we pick up the same ideas here. Ezekiel 39 and verse 17. Ezekiel, of course, is a little bit later, obviously, than Zephaniah, but not much later. Ezekiel 39 and verse 17. And thou, son of man, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, speak unto every feathered fowl and to every beast of the field, assemble yourselves and come. Gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice that I do sacrifice for you. Even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that ye may eat flesh and drink blood. This is virtually identical to what is in the Zephaniah. Verse 18, ye shall eat the flesh of the mighty, drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams, of lambs, and of goats, of bullocks, all of them fatlings of Bashan. And ye shall eat fat till ye be full, and drink blood till ye be drunken, of my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed unto you. Thus shall be filled at my table with horses and chariots, with mighty men, with all men of war, saith the Lord Yahweh. And so this idea of the armies of the nations, here sacrificed in Ezekiel upon the mountains of Israel, and upon Jerusalem in particular, carries forward this idea of the fullness of the day of Yahweh. It comes upon Judah first. Zechariah tells us that two-thirds will be cut off and die. And then it is extended upon all the heathen who have exceeded in this matter. So coming back again to verse 7 of Zephaniah 1, it says, Yahweh hath prepared a sacrifice, he hath bid his guests. Now the word bid, you'll notice in the margin, is Hebrew sanctified. Sanctified. And as those who punished Babylon, in Isaiah 13 and verse 3, they're called my sanctified ones. That's those who punish Babylon, was it? My sanctified ones, in Isaiah 13 and verse 13. Jeremiah 22. This is Babylon, who are my sanctified ones, who come against Judah there. Jeremiah 22. So these are the sanctified ones. Yahweh's put hooks in their jaws, as it were. He has brought them down upon the land of Judah. Jeremiah 22 and verse 6. Verse 6. For thus saith Yahweh unto the king's house of Judah, thou art Gilead unto me, and the head of Lebanon. Yet surely I'll make thee a wilderness, and cities which are not inhabited, and I will prepare destroyers against thee. Now the word prepare there is sanctifiers. I will bring sanctifiers. I will sanctify destroyers against thee. I'll sanctify destroyers against thee, everyone with his weapons, and they shall cut down thy choice cedars, the mighty men, and cast them into the fire. So whenever a nation is brought by their armies to perform Yahweh's judgments, he sanctifies them for that task. Now that's not making them holy in the normal way in which we speak of it, but it means that it is his angels who have arranged human affairs and brought them to do his will. And they've spoken of as sanctified ones because he speaks of these destructions as a sacrifice that is made. And by that means the land is cleansed. Well, Zephaniah again, and verse 8 this time. Verse 8, it shall come to pass in the day of Yahweh's sacrifice, if the day of Yahweh is at hand, now we have the day of Yahweh's sacrifice, that I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with strange apparel. Now, in this you'll notice there's something missing. It mentions the king's children, it mentions the princes, but it does not mention the king. King Josiah is evidently expressly excluded. Because of his heart and because of his reforms, he was not to see the judgment himself. When it comes to the end of verse 8, such as are clothed with strange apparel, the Revised Version put it as foreign dress. They have forsaken Yahweh's dress. Let's turn to Numbers chapter 15. What is Yahweh's dress? Numbers chapter 15. I think we ought to appreciate, brethren and sisters, that there is such a thing as a dress and a whole demeanor which is fitting of those who are Yahweh's. And there is an address and demeanor which is fitting of the world, but is unfitting for Christ's people. So Numbers 15 and verse 37. Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them that they make them fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, that they put upon the fringe of the borders a riband of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it, and remember all the commandments of Yahweh, and do them. And that ye seek not after your own heart, and use your own eyes after which ye used to go a-whoring, that ye may remember and do all my commandments, and be holy unto your God. I am Yahweh your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am Yahweh your God. Now, this riband of blue was there as a reminder of their obligations under the covenant to observe the law of Yahweh. I imagine, of course, that for many people the fringe of blue eventually lost its significance. But what would be very obvious, was anyone who did not wear the fringe of blue. Clearly, anyone who did not wear the fringe of blue was being provocative. They were being deliberately rebellious. And I've no doubt they said, we have a freedom, we have rights, why should we? And as brethren, well, young people sometimes say, it's the heart that counts, not what you look like. The simple fact is that then and now, how we dress is a very clear indication of what is in the heart. And I would suggest that in many ways now, once we go away from this place, a lot of the dress that is worn is not the kind of dress which identifies us with Christ, but identifies us with the world. We used to say years ago, and this was unquestionably true, that when we were out in the city, we could always spot a Christadelphian. Now, in the days when dress was far more sober than today and far more modest, nevertheless, you could see a Christadelphian. There was just something about them. I can hardly explain it, but it was so. What really disturbs me today is I see Christadelphians out, and I don't recognize them as Christadelphians. Their dress is extraordinary. I was working on the stand which my employer had at the Royal Show, just one night. And some young people came on the stand and looked at me, and they looked such a mess that I thought, oh no, I hope they go away. And I turned away, and I tried to avoid them, but they followed me, tapped me on the shoulder and spoke to me. And I thought, oh no, they really look the dreadful types. And they introduced themselves to me as brother and sister. And I couldn't believe it. I just did not want to be seen associated with them. The other people on the stand were looking at me. As they held out their hands to shake hands to me, the others looked at me in absolute astonishment. They couldn't believe that I would shake hands with those reptiles. And they were brother and sister. What are we doing? What are we doing? Let me tell you something, young men. I hate black. And I'll tell you why. Black is intended to be frightening and aggressive. It is not for nothing that the Aboriginal flag is black, yellow, and red. It is very aggressive. It is a very fighting combination of colours. And a lot of young men now are wearing black tops. And it really gives an impression that you are aggressive. And it puts fear into men and women of my age, and it's intended to, by the world. But is that what you want to portray? Get rid of your black tops. It's not part of the dress of Christ. Now verse 9 of Zephaniah chapter 1. In the same day also will I punish all those that leap on the threshold, which fill their masters' houses with violence and deceit. It surely comes back to the superstition from the Philistine god Dagon. You remember in the 1st of Samuel chapter 5 verses 1 to 5. How that the Philistine god Dagon fell down on its face before the ark, and the head was broken off on the threshold. As a result, they wouldn't step on the threshold, they leapt over the threshold. It seems to be some combination here from that, that now you've got this same kind of superstition, the same kind of idolatry that is picked up in Judah. It says at the end of verse 9, which fill their master's houses with violence and deceit. Now that's just the same as the age of the flood. It was an age of violence and deceit. Those things are mentioned in connection with the flood. It's also picked up, by the way, in Psalm 72. In Psalm 72 and verse 14, you remember Psalm 72 is a psalm which describes what life will be like in the kingdom. In Psalm 72 verse 14 it says, he shall redeem their soul from deceit and violence, which is a clear indication that the last days are marked by deceit and violence, which they certainly are. In verse 10 now, he says, it shall come to pass in that day, that saith Yahweh, there shall be noise of a cry from the fish gate. The fish gate, we think, was in the north wall of the city. And a howling from the second, which is in the lower part of the city. And a great crashing from the hills. This is the crashing of destruction. So you've got a cry of terror from the fish gate, howling with fear from the lower, and a great crashing of destruction in the hills, which seem to be Zion and probably Moriah. And then in verse 11, howl ye inhabitants of Maktesh, and the word Maktesh means pounding place, and that's Jerusalem being pounded by the judgment in the day of Yahweh. For all the merchant people are cut down, all they that bear silver are cut off. The merchant people, well, they was the Canaanites. They were the merchant people, but here it's Jerusalemites. Jerusalemites. They were to remove the Canaanites from the land and slay utterly man, woman and child when they inherited the land. But now they're the same. With their ill-gotten wealth, which is gained by deceit and violence. Wealth which they've heaped up for themselves in a day of judgment. Wealth in which they have trusted, but God cannot be bought. Verse 12. It shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and punish, this is all lamps of course, and punish the men that are settled on their lees, that say in their heart, Yahweh will not do good, neither will he do evil. Clearly, Jerusalem with lamps comes from the time of the Passover. You know, it was a practice to search throughout their houses for any leaven. In fact, it later became a practice of children to deliberately hide around the house some leaven. So that as they went around the house with their lamps searching for it at the before the feast of the Passover, they could actually find leaven, some way in involving the children, and removing it from their houses. What is being taught here, of course, is that Yahweh will search and there will be no hiding. He will find out all those who constitute leaven in ecclesial life. As Paul in 1 Corinthians 5 says, keep the feast not with the old leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And he's not talking about what we eat at the feast, he's talking about the manner of persons we are. If we come into our assembly with malice and wickedness, it is the old leaven which finds no part in the Passover of Christ. We have to come with hearts that are of sincerity and truth. And Yahweh will search us with lamps. There's going to be searching judgment. What about this punish the men that are settled on their lees? Now, lees is the sediment that comes down when the wine is settled. And the wine actually has to be decanted. Normally today, wine is decanted off the lees. But the lees are curdled or thickened. That's actually what the margin says. Curded or thickened. And it's talking about, obviously, the ungodly here. It's talking about the sediment, the smut, the dirt amongst the nation has settled down And Yahweh will remove off that with the godly, and leave behind to be cast away in judgment the ungodly. Now this is the time, we believe, when Josiah's book of the law was found. And Josiah was moved as he read that book of the law. But look at the heart of the people at the end of verse 12, that say in their heart, "Oh, it's all right for king. But Yahweh will not do good, neither will he do evil." Let Josiah get carried away with his book, but I don't think it means anything to us. We're all right. They didn't care. Now today we have more knowledge, I think, than ever before. There's so much out of the word that's been opened unto us. What are we doing with that knowledge? Are we saying, "Well, we're all right. We've got knowledge. The day of Yahweh will overthrow the world. It won't come upon us. We'll be saved out of it." These words are intended to be a challenge to us. Actually, the interesting thing is that when it says at the end of verse 12, "Yahweh will not do good, neither will he do evil," those words had been previously used by Yahweh of the idols. Idols had been mocked with Yahweh's challenge that they will not do good, neither will they do evil. An idol is nothing. You will find that in Isaiah 41 and verse 23 and Jeremiah 10 and verse 5. That was Isaiah 41 verse 23 and Jeremiah 10 verse 5. In those places, the idols were mocked with these words, but now the people are using them of Yahweh himself. It's the people who are now challenging Yahweh. So we read in verse 14 here, "The great day of Yahweh is near. It is near and hasteth greatly." They thought he'll do nothing. "It is near and it's coming very fast." And events are moving faster and faster. In the Middle East, in Russia, in Europe, things are picking up pace. We never had so much happen in such a short compass of time before. "The day of Yahweh hasteth greatly. Even the voice of the day of Yahweh," there's a clear voice shouting to us now, "the mighty man shall cry there bitterly." As it comes upon him, the mighty man is going to cry bitterly. Why? He's trusted in his weapons and he's trusted in his strength, but in the day of Yahweh it means nothing. There is America bragging, "We've arrived, people will look up to us, people respect us." They've used their weapons with devastating effect upon Iraq. Do you think they're going to go on doing that? Of course not. And the mighty man will cry bitterly. For fear and for pain, because he cannot help himself in this day. It goes on in verse 15, "The day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of wasteness and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of the trumpet of war, and alarm against the fenced cities and against the high towers." This verse 15, you might like to compare Joel 2 and verse 2. I'm not going to turn to it now, but in effect it speaks of the darkness and the gloominess of this day of trouble. As in Joel chapter 2, the Gogian host presses down from the north and sweeps down through the land of Israel and plants his tabernacles in the glorious holy mountain. Because they have rejected the light of Yahweh's truth, then gross darkness shall cover the people. That's what it says in Isaiah 60 verses 1 and 2. And people, it's not only Judah, but it's all nations. They've rejected the light of Yahweh's truth. Gross darkness shall cover the people. It shall be a day of wrath, of trouble, distress, wasteness, darkness, gloominess, clouds. And so it goes on. Verse 17. And I will bring distress upon men that they shall walk like blind men, because they have sinned against Yahweh, and their blood shall be poured out as dust and their flesh as dung. It's the blood and the flesh of sacrifice. Their blood shall be poured out as dust, their flesh as dung. The blood and the flesh of the sacrifices upon the mountains of Israel. So we come to Zephaniah chapter 2. We're not going to cover much of this particular chapter. But what we want to notice here is, as we start Zephaniah chapter 2, it's very similar to Haggai's call. Now, you know the call of the prophet Haggai? Consider your ways. Though those words aren't used by Zephaniah, it's obviously very much in the same vein. Consider your ways. And we read in verse 1. Gather yourselves together, yea, gather together, O nation not desired. By the way, the word gather there is actually sift. Sift. You might wonder, how can gather yourselves together be sift? It implies self-examination. When we come week by week, brethren and sisters, we are to sift ourselves. We are to examine ourselves in the light of what is taught us concerning Christ in the emblems. It's a self-examination, one by one. We tend to do a broad brush painting. Say, that's a weak ecclesia, that's a strong ecclesia, we're this, they're that. What it says here is not a broad brush, it's sift yourselves one by one. O nation not desired. Now, the margin gives us, not desirous, but what it actually is, literally in the Hebrew, is does not grow pale. What does that mean? O nation that does not grow pale. When do you grow pale? With fear. With fear. Here is a nation which knows no fear. So the Revised Standard Version puts the word shameless. O nation, shameless. No fear. Talk about the day of Yahweh glibly. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, wonderful prophecies. Christ is coming. And then make their plans for anything. But what is expedient in Christ? So it goes on in verse 2. Before the decree bring forth, before the day passes the chaff, before the fierce anger of Yahweh come upon you, before the day of Yahweh's anger, see how it's building up all the time, isn't it? Before the day of Yahweh's anger come upon you, seek ye Yahweh, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment, seek righteousness, seek meekness, it may be ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger. Not many, but the meek of the earth shall be hid. And the Lord Jesus Christ picks it up with the words, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. In Matthew 5, verse 5. And the whole idea here of meek, of course, is humility towards God. It's not just one to another. This is before God. This is fear before God that's spoken of here. Peter says in his first epistle, chapter 5 and verse 6, God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. That's the message here. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Seek ye Yahweh, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Now, there's an expression. Wrought his judgment. That's picked up from Deuteronomy, chapter 30 and verse 16. The idea of his judgments are his commandments, you see. Deuteronomy 30, verse 16 says, keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments. They're the word of God. These are the judgments which must be kept. Jeremiah has it in Jeremiah 5, verses 4 and 5. They know not the way of Yahweh and the judgment of their God. May know not the way of Yahweh and the judgment of their God. So the judgment of God is his ways. It's observing his commandments. And it is only seen in those who we have here going on in verse 3, seek righteousness. Seek righteousness. What does the Lord say? Well, he said in Matthew 6 and verse 33, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And as a people who are expecting to see the day of Yahweh, that's very good advice. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Well, what does that imply? It implies that we are men and women who can recognize sin, recognize it for what it is, and avoid it. The problem is, we are getting so used to the philosophies of the age. In fact, they're even being brought in sometimes. The philosophies that have come from brethren like myself, who go on courses at work, and we're told how to manage people, how to handle problem people, how to organise things, how to get a good morale out of your staff, etc. And at first I thought, this is parallel with the truth. It's the kind of ideas we get out of the Bible. And then I began to realise it wasn't. It is not possible that man by thinking can develop righteousness. The heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who shall know it? It's not the wisdom from above, it's the wisdom that is from beneath, with the idea of manipulating people. We don't want to be manipulators of people, do we? We want to be a people who uphold the wisdom of God, which is encouraging one another to persevere in the faith in the last days, but not manipulation. It's gnosis, science, falsely so called. And some of those philosophies are appearing from some platforms. Now, it goes on here to say in that verse 3 there, seek meekness. Seek meekness. Or as Isaiah 66 verse 2 says, those that are poor and of a contrite spirit and trembleth at my word. We don't do that, do we? Poor, contrite spirit trembles at my word. Now we've got prophecies like Obadiah and Zephaniah. And we look at this day of wrath and trouble and distress, of wasteness and desolation and darkness. Do we tremble? What's the word? What effect is the word having on us? Do we tremble? Seek meekness. It may be, it says at the end of verse 3, ye shall be hid. Obviously an allusion here to Zephaniah's name. Hidden of Yah. It may be, ye shall be hidden of Yah in the day of Yahweh's anger. So you see, there's always a faithful remnant. And that's the point which we want to now start to bring out more and more from Zephaniah. Always there's a faithful remnant. The picture is not completely of doom. It's there to forewarn us. Now, we must identify with the remnant. So let's come to Psalm 27. Psalm 27. And in Psalm 27 verse 5, of this remnant, and of this hiding by Yah of his remnant who are faithful. Psalm 27 verse 5. In the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me upon a rock. Even though verse 6 mentions the enemies round about. Psalm 31 and verse 19. Psalm 31 and verse 19. Oh, how great is thy goodness which thou hast laid up for them that fear thee. We might say, how great is thy wrath, but here it's, how great is thy goodness which thou hast laid up for them that fear thee, which thou hast wrought for them that trust in thee before the sons of men. Thou shalt hide them, you see, hidden of Yah. Thou shalt hide them in the secret of thy presence from the pride of man. Thou shalt keep them secretly in a pavilion from the strifes of tongue. Blessed be Yahweh. Now, the remaining verses of Zephaniah chapter 2, that's verses 4 to 15, are judgment on heathen nations. And though they have a lot of interest in them, we're not going to concern ourselves with that tonight. These are the nations which are contiguous with Israel and are confederate with Gog, and therefore are judged because they're confederate with Gog in the day of Yahweh's anger. What we want to do now is move on to chapter 3 and just bring out one or two points from the third chapter. Particularly, you'll notice, in verses 1 to 7, we have the sins of Judah. In Zephaniah 3, verses 1 to 7, we have the sins of Judah. It starts off in verse 1 by saying, "Woe to her that is filthy and polluted, to the oppressing city." So Jerusalem was filthy, polluted, and the oppressing city. But the word filthy there doesn't mean filthy. It means rebellious or defiant. It's a generation who are rebellious and defiant, who don't want the old standards. And look at the brethren who support them as fuddy-duddies and out of touch and not moving with the times. And it becomes an oppressing city. So you see, it's rebellious and defiant, and therefore defiled. It's filthy because she's defiled by her attitude, her sin. Look at verse 2. Now here's the problem. Here's the whole crux of the problem, verse 2. She obeyed not the voice of Yahweh, of course. She received not correction. She trusted not in Yahweh. She drew not near to her God, which evidently is prayer, of course. You can only draw nigh to God by prayer, as brethren and sisters. So here's the whole nub of the problem. Pride, you see, will not accept correction. And because their pride prevented them accepting correction, the prophets and the priests in Jerusalem polluted her. Because it is the prophets and the priests which are the leaders in this. Verse 5. Well, actually, verse 4 says, you see, her prophets are light and treacherous persons. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary. They've done violence to the law. So there it is. The false prophets, evidently. Treacherous persons. They're light and no depth. And then you notice the priests pollute the sanctuary. They swear by Yahweh and by Baal, or Molech. Then verse 5. The just Yahweh is in the midst thereof. Now that's something I hadn't realized. There were all their host of heaven, there was Baal, there was all these treacherous and light persons, and one that they never saw was there. The just Yahweh was in the midst. And he was watching everything that was going on. But unlike the people, it says in verse 5, he will not do iniquity. Every morning doth he bring his judgment to light, he faileth not. But the unjust knoweth no shame. See, there's another there. But the unjust knew no shame. They laughed. They thought they had got away with it. They didn't realize Yahweh was there. And he calls to the bar of his judgment. So we turn to verse 8. Verses 8 to 20 now of this third chapter are the restoration of the remnant of Israel. Verses 8 to 20, the restoration of the remnant of Israel. As we read in verse 8, "Therefore wait ye upon me, saith Yahweh, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy." forget sometimes, Yahweh is a jealous God, and jealousy burns like a fire. And in the Song of Solomon it tells us, it's a fire that waters can't quench. It burns like a fire. Wait ye upon me is the call. Obviously that's addressed to the meek of the land. Hang on. As the world gets worse, and problem after problem arises in ecclesial life, we become demoralized. No doubt about it. We become demoralized. Every marriage breakdown makes it a little bit more difficult for the next marriage. It has a rolling effect, a demoralizing effect. Every sin by one brother sets a pattern and an example for another by which he might fall. And it's more catching than a good example, unfortunately. The cry is, wait ye upon me. Don't let go. Hold on. Until the day that I rise up to the prey. And it's hasting greatly. Now the result of this day is seen in verses 9 and 10. For then will I turn to the peoples, it's plural here, peoples, a pure language, the margin says lip, Hebrew, a pure lip, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one consent. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants, even the daughter of my dispersed, shall bring mine offering. Now then, what's this mean? A pure lip. And it's peoples, plural. Well, you remember, before Babel, the world was of one lip. That's in Genesis 1, verse 1 and verse 6. Genesis 1, verse 1 and verse 6, the world was of one lip. Means, obviously, one language. Here, to speak with a pure lip involves calling upon the name of Yahweh. In other words, their speech will be truth, and the praise of Yahweh. It will be truth and the praise of Yahweh. Now, as an addition to that, we can also say it surely implies there will be one language as there was before the flood, before Babel. The truth comes in basically one language, you see. It's in Hebrew. That's the language of Revelation. And when it says a pure lip here, it doesn't say that everybody will speak Hebrew. I think that's the implication. What it is implying, what it's meaning primarily, as everybody in that day when Yahweh reveals himself and has removed the wicked, will speak truth and praise Yahweh. What Hebrews in chapter 13 and verse 15 calls the sacrifice of praise. The sacrifice of praise. Now, it also says, the end of verse 9, to serve him with one consent. And the word consent is put in the margin as shoulder. One shoulder. Well, it's like the ox, you see. The yoke is put upon the shoulder of the ox. And he pulls. And I think this is the idea here. That people are going to be put their shoulder, as it were, to the work of the truth. They're going to take upon that yoke of Christ. They'll go up to Jerusalem to seek the Lord of Yahweh at his mouth. They will take his commandments and do them. And they're going to push with the shoulder to the work of the truth at last. What about verse 10? From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants. Let me give you that from the Revised Version. The Revised Version says, from beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, they shall bring mine offering. Here it's got my suppliants. They shall bring mine offering. The offering is at the end of verse 10. Revised Version says, from beyond the rivers of Ethiopia they shall bring mine offering. What's at the end of verse 10 is moved forward in the verse. They shall bring mine offering, my suppliants, the daughter of my dispersed. That is, from beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, that means from the furthest bounds. The idea is from very distant parts. Beyond the rivers of Ethiopia is a way of expressing as far as can be imagined. Groups of Jews will be brought to return out of the nations of their dispersion. They shall bring mine offering, my suppliants, the daughter of my dispersed. Now, I think the word offering has a contrast here, you see. Previously, we've spoken of a sacrifice. Now, sacrifice involves blood. You can't have a sacrifice without blood. It'd be meaningless. But an offering was a bloodless gift. I think that's the implication here. This is those who are returning, not those for destruction, those who are going to form the inhabitants of the kingdom of Israel upon the mountains of Israel under Christ. So this is a gift, an offering, a bloodless gift. Verse 11. In that day shalt thou not be ashamed for all thy doings, wherein thou hast transgressed against me. So, this day of judgment upon the nations is also a time of Israel's purging. Out of Israel is going to be removed all those that offend. Verse 11 again. In that day shalt thou not be ashamed for all thy doings wherein thou hast transgressed against me. For then I will take away out of the midst of thee them that rejoice in thy pride. And thou shalt no more be haughty because of my holy mountain, or in my holy mountain, you'll notice there, no more be haughty in my holy mountain as in times past. I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and poor people, and they shall trust in the name of Yahweh. The Septuagint has a meek and lowly people. I will leave in the midst of thee a meek and a lowly people. They shall trust in the name of Yahweh. The remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies. Neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. There you are. It's the day of Israel's purging, removing all those who offend, as it says, transgressed against me, in verse 11. Ezekiel 20. Here it is. Ezekiel 20. Here is the second Exodus. That is the bringing of the dispersed of Israel from the four corners of the earth to bring them back again to the land in the time of Christ. And it says in Ezekiel 20 and verse 38, verse 38. Of this time when they would be brought back and are disciplined into the bonds of the covenant, in verse 37. Then verse 38 says, and I will purge out from among you the rebels, and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel, and ye shall know that I am Yahweh. Now that's very similar to what happened in the first Exodus. They came out of Egypt, but the elders did not go into the land. Only Joshua and Caleb. They perished in the wilderness for their rebellion. In the second Exodus, I'll purge out from among you the rebels. I'll bring them out from the countries where they sojourn, but they won't go into the land. In the process, they'll be purged. They will be removed. So that, as we've just read in Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 13, the remnant of Israel. It's a remnant now that actually come into the land, even a remnant of those that started the second Exodus. They shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies. Because of, that becomes, at the end of verse 11, becomes in my holy mountain. And they shall trust, the end of verse 12, they shall trust in the name of Yahweh. It literally is take refuge. They shall take refuge. I mean, this is a day of anger, it's a day of wrath. Europe is turned into a lake of fire. Under the judgment of Yahweh, it spreads upon the Catholic nations. They shall take refuge in the name of Yahweh. And then you see at the end of verse 13 we get that expression, none shall make them afraid. Well, We've heard that before. That brings an echo, doesn't it? None shall make them afraid. We know that from Micah chapter 4, verse 4. Every man shall dwell under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. But actually, it goes back earlier than that. It goes back to the law. It goes back to Leviticus. In Leviticus 26 and verse 6, it says, "If ye walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, I will give you peace in the land, and none shall make you afraid." Leviticus 26, verse 6. That's the condition. Walk in my statutes, keep my commandments. Well, verse 14 then. "Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all thine heart, O daughter of Jerusalem." The remnant of Israel rejoice greatly in Jesus Christ, their King. They sing, they shout, they rejoice with gladness of heart, the daughter of Jerusalem. "Yahweh hath taken away thy judgments, he hath cast out thine enemy. The King of Israel, even Yahweh, is in the midst of thee. Thou shalt not see evil any more. In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, Fear thou not, and to Zion, let not thine hands be slack. Yahweh thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save, he will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love, he will joy over thee with singing." Not only do they rejoice in Yahweh, but his love is real. It's genuine. He gave his own son, his only begotten son, whom he loved very much. And it's an indication of the love which Yahweh has for his people. It comes out here. "Though he is mighty and his judgments are terrible, he will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love." The word "rest" there, by the way, means be silent in his love. You get that in the margin. He will be silent in his love. What does that mean? It means that he will remember their sins no more. His love is such that he will not go on accusing them. That will be past. He will be silent on the things of the past. Now, that comes out in other prophets. It comes out in Jeremiah 31 and verse 34. "I will remember their sin no more." It comes out in Micah 7 and verse 18. It comes out in Romans 11 and verse 27. "In the day when I take away their sins." It comes out in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 7, which says, "Love covers all sins." 1 Corinthians 13 verse 7. And Yahweh is there. Then the last verses. "I will gather them that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly who are of thee, to whom the reproach of it was a burden. Behold, at that time I will undo all that afflict thee, and I will save her that halteth," that's Israel, "gather her that was driven out, and I'll get them praise and fame in every land where they have been put to shame. At that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you, for I'll make you a name and a praise among all the people of the earth, when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith Yahweh." Verse 18, "I will gather them that are sorrowful who are of thee," that is, of Jerusalem, from verse 16. It shall be said to Jerusalem. Those who are of thee are of Jerusalem, the true Jerusalemites. Verse 19, "And do all that afflict thee, save her that halteth, get them praise and fame in every land." That will fulfill Deuteronomy 26, verses 18 and 19. And then in verse 20, when it says, "I turn back your captivity," when I turn back your captives, is the word, when I turn back your captives before your eyes, you'll get that in the Exodus, in Exodus 14, verse 13. "Ye have seen," or Deuteronomy 29, verse 2, "ye have seen all that Yahweh did before your eyes in the land of Egypt." Now, before their eyes, they'll have seen it all happen, and they will fear Yahweh. That was Deuteronomy 29, verse 2. So, brethren and sisters, once again, if Yahweh will pour out his judgment on the nations, how much more on Israel? That's the lesson here. How much more on Israel, who have the greater responsibility? And if on Israel, what about us? Isn't our responsibility even deeper? You see what the difficulty was in verse 7 of this chapter 3. Verse 7 said, surely thou wilt fear me, thou wilt receive instruction, so their dwelling should not be cut off, howsoever I punish them. So the whole idea of this was that they would be brought to repentance. Yahweh wanted them to receive correction. He didn't want to destroy them utterly. But they would not receive that correction. Now what about us? Surely, brethren and sisters, if we will receive the correction of Yahweh, and if we will tremble at the word of his prophets, verse 17 becomes true. He will save. He will rejoice over us with joy. He will be silent about the things wherein we have done wrong and we have failed. All that will be past. And he will joy over us with singing. There is the day of Yahweh at hand, brethren and sisters. Seek ye Yahweh. It's chapter 2, verse 3. This is the exhortation. Seek ye Yahweh, all ye meek of the earth which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness. Seek meekness. It may be ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger.
Let us bring our study class to a conclusion.